As America's national parks celebrate their centennial, a local rider celebrates them as well. Just ahead, we'll speak with the TU's Mark Woods. Good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9. Make sure to check out the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and check out video on demand segments with our partner TVJax.com. Just ahead, author Mark Woods on his ode to the national parks out today, Lassoing the Sun. What are your memories of trips to the parks? We want to hear them. Call us up now at 549-2937. Then later, it's our book club today. We're celebrating literature all through the hour as our Stacey Goldring leads that discussion. Plus, TEDx Jacksonville on the power of music will tell you about their special event this week. All of that ahead. But first this hour, it's the incredible tale of one man's year-long journey visiting America's national parks. A few years ago, Florida Times Union columnist Mark Woods won the Eugene C. Pulliam Fellowship. That's a $75,000 award given each year to one American writer. Woods won this prize with a unique idea: to spend a year traveling the country and visiting the national parks. By the way, they turn 100 years old in August. So all throughout 2012, Mark visited one park a month. He started with a sunrise in Acadia in Maine, and he ended with a sunset in Haleakala, Hawaii. The result? It's the new book, Lassoing the Sun. And it's more than just a memoir. It's about the parks, but also about family, the legacies we inherit and the ones we leave behind, all set against the backdrop of what Ken Burns calls America's best idea. Mark Woods, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What are your questions for the TU's Mark Woods, and what are your memories of visits to the national parks? What are your thoughts about preserving the national parks, which are now deeply in debt, by the way? We'll talk about that, too. Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937, or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, or weigh in on our Facebook page. The book's out today. Congratulations.
Thank you.
This has been a long time in the making. Several, what, 5 years?
Yeah, basically the process started in 2011 when I won the fellowship, and the project proposal was always built around the idea that I'd have something out in 2016, and if you'd asked me last fall, I was starting to wonder whether I'd
make whether you'd make it.
Make that happen. But yeah, here we are about 2 months from the centennial, so it's perfect timing.
And that was your idea, was to publish something in conjunction with this anniversary of the parks.
Right. When I got the email, came into my inbox about this potential fellowship back in 2011, and I think I deleted it once or twice, and then I read it and I thought, well, what if I had a year off, what would I do? And I thought, well, I think at that point my daughter had asked me shortly before that, like, she loves Disney and I'm not a big Disney fan, and she was like, well, what's your Disney? And I kind of thought it out, and I said, well, it's I don't know, it's not theme parks, it's national parks. And so I think then, but I thought, well, how can I make that worthy of a fellowship? And, you know, they're often, that fellowship goes to some pretty weighty, meaty topics. But I thought, well, national parks will be coming up on their centennial in 2016. Ken Burns, Ansel Adams, John Muir, many others have documented the history beautiful, but what's the future of the park? So that was kind of in a nutshell what the proposal was, to look ahead to 2016 and beyond. And yeah, now here we are, 2016.
Speaking of Ken Burns, he has endorsed your book, I'm very excited to see, with a blurb, a quote on the cover.
Yes, we have to tell the story of that.
I'll let you tell it, because this is a long story. Well, you know what? We'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
Let's talk about what's inside this book. You started with a visit to Acadia National Park in Maine and watched the sun come up over the easternmost point, almost, of America in this beautiful national park.
Right. Cadillac Mountain in Acadia is the place where sunlight first hits U.S. soil every year, the first sunrise in America. So I kind of like that symbolism of standing there January 1, and I contacted folks up in Bar Harbor in near Acadia and said, are there folks who go up every year and watch the sunrise? They said, sure. And several people mentioned the same woman, Lily Pugh, and said, you should contact Lily. And so I did, and I asked her, if can I tag along for your tradition? So that's what I did. I started the year with a sunset, and as you said, I kind of followed the sun across America, sort of, to Hawaii and Haleakala National Park, and December 31st ended with a sunset atop the volcanic crater there.
We actually have a little audio that you recorded when you went out to the park in Hawaii. This is sunrise at Haleakala National Park, I believe.
Haleakala, yes.
Haleakala. Let's listen. Can you tell us about that?
Well, going to the top of Haleakala for sunrise is a big thing to do for tourists, and there's hundreds of people gather and watch the sun come up, and it is stunning because the clouds kind of sit below the summit, so you just feel like you're on top of the world. And this is one of the rangers who greets the sun as it rises each morning, and so she stands there and waits to the right moment, which just sun starts to hit her face and breaks into that chant, which I asked her afterwards, to summarize it for me and translate it, and basically kind of meant, seize the day, appreciate what we have, and make the most of the day kind of spirit, which I, the story behind the title, Lassoing the Sun, is that the demigod Maui lassoed the sun to make the day last longer for his mother, because the day was too short. So that's kind of where that title came from. Was
nice.
I kind of seize the day, make the most of this day.
And that had a special meaning for you, didn't it? Because in the midst of you visiting these parks, you had a family illness strike the Woods family.
Right. So that, here it is. This, I'm thinking of it as best year of my life. I've won this fellowship. I have this, greatest assignment ever. February 7th, 5 weeks into the year, I'm out at Saguaro National Park in Tucson, where my mom lives. And the day I get there, she's told, my mom's as healthy a 70-year-old as I know, hikes every day, eats incredibly, ridiculously healthy. She's told she has a bad, inoperable cancer and has months to live. So that instantly changed the year. In some ways made everything feel, the project feel meaningless, in other ways made it feel even more meaningful because she loved the park so much. So yes, that made, and then the end result makes the book, I think, very different, because it's what started out as this journalistic idea of kind of studying the national parks as I would as a reporter became much more personal instead.
And as people read this book, they'll learn so much, not just about the parks, but about your family. If you could, I'd like you to read a passage from Lassoing the Sun. Could you do that for us?
Sure. Although I'm book signing at the Bookmark, I told Rona how I hate even looking at something after I've written it. Once I'm done with it, once it's on the page and I can't change it. So this may be torture, but I'll, which part, okay. Okay, so this is at the end, after I come back from Acadia, and I'm back home. From the comfort of my warm Florida home, I read that and thought about Maine, the blowing wind, the diamond glints, the shining stars, and the new dawn. I thought about how my parents went to Acadia for one of their anniversaries and watched the sunrise atop a Cadillac. I thought about how Dad sometimes made statements about death that were half joking, half serious. When I'm gone, he'd say. When he was gone, he told Mom he wanted her to find someone else. When he was gone, he also wanted her to know he was still with her. He said it would be like the love letter Union soldier Sullivan Ballou had written to his wife. He would be in the wind. Quote, I shall always be near you. If there is a soft breeze upon your cheek, it shall be my breath. Ken Burns featured a reading of the letter in his Civil War series, along with a violin playing Ashikan Farewell. After Dad died, I noticed that Mom had a cassette tape of that song in her car. A couple years later, for her 60th birthday, Mom decided that she wanted the rest of the family to do a rafting trip through the Grand Canyon. At one point, as we drifted along a calm stretch of the Colorado, deep in the canyon, our guide, a small woman with ripped arms, stopped rowing and pulled out what looked like a musical instrument case. She unlatched it, and sure enough, she had brought a violin with her. She rested it on her shoulders and began to play. A few notes into it, I realized what she was playing, Ashikan Farewell.
And that's a passage from Mark Wood's new book, Lassoing the Sun, out today, just a couple months in advance of the National Parks celebrating 100 years in this country. So let's go to your thoughts right now. What are your memories of visits to the parks with your parents, with your kids? Give us a call, 549-2937. Leo in Jacksonville. Hi, Leo. Good morning.
Yeah, hello. I agree that the national parks are probably our greatest treasure along with the American people. I had a question to your guest. There was discussion about privatizing corporate sponsorship of some of the national parks due to the funding shortage. And I read this article from one of the Park Service directors back in the 50s, and he said that probably underfunding the parks is the best thing that can happen for preservation. Obviously, he was opposed to corporate sponsoring. I was curious what your speaker thought about that subject.
Sure. Let's talk about that, because as we've been learning in recent months, the National Park Service is dealing with debt, and they have proposed rules for what they call donor recognition or naming rights in the parks. What do you think about that?
Right. It is a hot topic, and there are a lot of corporate tie-ins and sponsorships. You see Subaru all over advertising about the centennial, and I think there's a mixed emotions about it. There's the Park Service needs money, and I think you can have ways to do that, but you have to stick to the core principles and not give away control of these things to any of these entities. And that's the problem, I think, that would be mixing that, and the problem with literally privatizing some of these things, I think you run into other issues.
Is it a slippery slope if they open the door to this?
Right, but then again, I think it's okay to have some, corporate tie-ins and, to have ways to, the buzz about the centennial is being fueled partly by some of these corporate sponsors.
That's especially National Geographic, as you said.
National Geographic, Subaru. Nature Valley. You see there's this branding that I think I'm okay with that.
549-2937. Barbara is in Jacksonville. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, it's Barbara Goodman. Hi, Melissa. Hi.
Oh, hi, our former National Park Superintendent. Good morning, Barbara.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. I couldn't let a call about the national parks go by without chiming in.
And I know Mark, you're enjoying retirement, but of course, so many know you through your wonderful tenure running the Timaquan Preserve National Park for many years here in Jacksonville.
Yes, thank you. And so Mark was kind enough to give me an advance copy. And Mark, I just wanted to congratulate you on the book. I've been enjoying it. I haven't finished it, but I've certainly been enjoying it. And I wanted to share that really, I had only been to national parks a couple times as a child. My real introduction was when I was 22, and my mother had just died of cancer. And my way of mourning her was I got in my VW van. It was back in the 70s, and I just drove from national park to national park throughout our country. Seeing national parks, and I did that for 3 months and went from West Coast to East Coast and back to the West Coast again, and never actually got all the way back to the West Coast. I stopped at Grand Tetons and got a job, and that's how my career started.
That was it.
So,
wow.
Yeah, that was it. But I really had, as I've been reading, have had some personal connections just with your family story, Mark. So I just wanted to share that.
Barbara Goodman, thank you so much for calling.
Well, thanks. And she was one of the people I sat down before the year began and kind of brainstormed things out. I think probably at the point where I wasn't even thinking in terms of this, what it became. And she probably told me that story, and I think I've forgotten. I know she started, I remembered she started the Grand Tetons and kind of was hooked. And
did that inspire you a little bit?
Yeah. But yeah, she was a one, as many people were, a wonderful resource to help me get started on this.
It's 549-2937. Mary is in Penny Farms, Florida. Mary, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Is this calling me?
Yeah, hi, Mary.
Oh, hi. I visited my first park, which was Yellowstone, when I was 2.5.
Uh-huh.
My parents came from two different parts of the country, and we traveled all around the U.S. when I was 2 to 3. And all I remember from Yellowstone was seeing the bears climbing the trees, the little bears.
But that's a great memory.
I grew up in China, and when we came back after the war, we made this long trip in 1946 from Arizona to Alberta, and we saw Yosemite and Sequoia and Redwood and Crater Lake, absolutely gorgeous, and came down from the Rockies through the Grand Tetons, and then eventually to Texas, where my uncle lived, and then saw Carlsbad Caverns. And I was just 14, and those were just wonderful times to see America and to learn America. And I'm so grateful that my parents did that for us,
yeah.
My sister and me.
Oh, Mary, thanks so much for sharing those memories. That's Mary and Penny Farms. I think so many of us have these vivid images in our minds of these visits when we were children because the parks are breathtaking.
Right, yeah. I think I talk about in the book how my parents didn't have a lot of money, but they found a way to do these trips, you know, pile us in the back of the station wagon, me and my two sisters fighting over the space. And, and you know, I've...
We didn't let our knees touch. That was really bad.
We drew
there
lines.
There was a line in the middle of the back seat for my brother and me.
Right.
You couldn't touch each other. There'd be a fight.
And I can tell you, I can remember, you know, I can't remember what I got for Christmas or my birthday when I was 10 years old, but I can tell you about the exact spot where I camped in the Redwoods. I can I can remember what it smelled like. I can remember what my pup tent felt like. I remember waking up and hearing Dad cooking the bacon sizzling over the campfire, and I can see that so vividly, and I think that's the power of these places and beyond the places that, you know, she talks about experiencing with her parents, that connection you have with your family when you kind of get away from the rat race of the day-to-day activities. And so it's a combination of just vacation and these amazing natural places.
Right. And I so hope that your book does what I think the PBS miniseries Ken Burns produced on the national parks did, which is inspire people to visit these parks. So now let's tell the Ken Burns story.
Yeah.
Because WJCT television viewers, of course, know Ken Burns, probably the best documentary filmmaker of our generation or many generations. And his series on the national parks called America's Best Idea was incredible. When you started working on this book, gosh, it's got to have been 3 or 4 years ago, I started nudging you and encouraging you to ask Ken Burns to write a blurb for your book jacket. And what did you say, Mark Woods? What did you say?
I think I was afraid to see you each time because you'd ask me.
I did. I was relentless.
Have you contacted them yet? No. I mean, he's too busy. He doesn't have the time.
You kept saying, oh, what if he says no or he won't do it? I remember that too. You're too modest.
You're too modest. I didn't have the nerve to reach out and try to make it happen. So somebody decided to swoop
somebody in. Pushy like me is what you're saying. So Nancy, let's thank Nancy Cable.
Exactly.
She is on our board here at WJCT, and she runs the Arthur Vining Davis Foundation, which is a national foundation that funds Ken Burns documentaries. It just so happens to be based in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. And when she brought Ken Burns to town a few months ago to visit and speak in the city, that's when I thought, she's the one that can make this happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so she reached out to Ken Burns, and then you told me this incredible story of how this quote from Burns made it onto your book jacket. Can you tell that story?
Well, yeah. So, Melissa, you helped make that happen, and we got a copy up to him and through Nancy, and one of the advanced copies, kind of this unedited manuscript. I hadn't heard back. Then I emailed her, and out of the blue, well, actually, I didn't even see it first. You called me on my cell phone, and you said, did you check your emails yet? And I hadn't. And I looked, and there was this amazing quote from Ken Burns.
Right. He and let me read it, just so I can brag on you and how good this book is. Ken Burns writes, "In this remarkable journey, Mark Woods captures the essence of our national parks, their serenity and majesty, complexity and vitality, and their power to heal." Ken Burns.
So once we
had
that, I called the publisher up in New York and said, "Guess what? We have a Ken Burns blurb." And of course, they were thrilled. So thrilled, apparently the book jacket was about to go to print that day or the next day. And
that's my favorite part of this story.
So she said, "I called production," and my editor said, "I called production," and we.
They literally say, "Stop the presses"?
I think it was close to that.
Because I really wish that was true, but I don't know if it is.
In book world, which is probably even more rare. But so yes, she said the production folks weren't thrilled with me at the last minute changing the book cover, but it'll be worth it. And I'm sure those words, however, I haven't counted, however many Ken Burns words there mean more than any... any number of the words I wrote on the inside as far as...
No, not at all. But so. I just couldn't be happier for you, and I'm so excited about it. And here are just a couple of tweets to Mark. Here's one from Julie. "I remember Acadia National Park in Maine in the fall with a view from Cadillac Mountain. It's breathtaking, diverse natural beauty." Here's a tweet for you from the Friends of the St. John's Ferry. "Most people in Jacksonville don't know that the Timaquan National Park is one of only 3 national park preserves. So you can always visit the Timaquan right here in our own backyard."
Right. Now, we have amazing National Park Service sites right in our backyard that tend to take for granted. And I say, yeah, the Theodore Roosevelt area right out by Fort Caroline is one of my favorites. Hiking the Willie Brown Trail out to Brown Marsh is one of my favorite spots.
Yeah, the late Willie Brown left all his land to the Park Service. I love that story. You wrote about that, too, in the paper. Here's an email from Rob. "Please ask Mark if there will be a beer and book signing event at Black Creek Outfitters."
Joe Butler, the owner of Black Creek, has talked about that. So hopefully, yes, we'll make that happen at some point this summer.
Let's go to Dennis in Jacksonville. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hi, Mark. It's really a pleasure speaking to you. I'm listening to everybody's stories, and it reminds me of my own journey. I've got an 18-year-old son, and he and I have had the privilege of being to something over 20 national parks together. And it's kind of like these great bookends that everybody has in their library, holding up this little book, which is our family history. And everything that I hear everybody says just reminds me of our own journey and all the trips that we took and how it's kind of enhanced through this looking glass of these national parks. And it's just been just a privilege to have been with him to so many of them. And there's so many memories. Somebody could take up a whole show with their own memories. And it's just a pleasure to hear yours.
Thanks, Dennis.
Yeah, part of me feels like this is self-serving, all my, all these memories of that year and of my family trips. But I think and I hope the reason it works is that people will see, maybe not the exact same places, maybe not the exact same stories, but they'll see some of their own family trips, some of their own having, a lot of baby boomers dealing with loss, losing parents, raising kids. So all those things kind of wrapped together. So it's, My version of a midlife crisis, I guess.
That's a pretty good one to have. I'm sure one your wife appreciates, too. No red sports car.
You're right.
And you know, I hope our kids have good memories. We've taken them to the Fort Caroline Memorial here to learn about that settlement. We've taken them to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and I think they'll always remember seeing the elk.
Mm-hmm.
Just walking, just running wild through the park.
Mm-hmm.
And we've taken them to Cumberland Island National Seashore to see the wild horses. And those are things that, for a child, I think really do. They those memories are imprinted on their brains, I hope, in a wonderful way.
Right. And, you know, my parents did that so well, and I talk about it in the book, I'm wondering whether I had done that with my daughter. And I think 5 years ago, if you'd asked me, I would have said maybe. Now I would say I hope so, because we went to the Redwoods, we went to Yellowstone, she's been to the Outer Banks, you know, Cape Hatteras National Seashore there. We camped on Cumberland Island. And as with when I was a child, it wasn't always perfect. There were some, you know, moments when you're fighting and you're
little hiccups, yep.
Why am I doing this? But as you said, I think there's something that's deeply embedded there that sticks, and 10 years, 20 years, you know, the rest of your life, you keep coming back to it.
Lisa is in St. Augustine. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning. I am so excited to share this morning, because I remember when I first read that Ms. Woods was going to do this sabbatical and hopefully eventually do this, and thinking how incredibly perfect it was, because his voice always has emerged from the media clutter to share things that are really profound and meaningful and usually very touching. And these national parks are kind of where our national soul resides. That's where, you know, like you've been saying, we connect with animals in context. We connect with our, you know, fellow travelers. We connect with our families. And as a fellow, like, cancer survivor, I can say, like, from the trips that we've had the last few couple years with our family, that the parks are really a place that can bring people in, put people back in touch with the things that really are valuable in life, are meaningful in life, and I am going to run out and buy this book for Father's Day, because I think it's a perfect way to celebrate my husband and his contact with her children and sharing, you know, those things. And I, last thing I wanted to say is thank you for all the Park Service friends of mine, the friends that work for the Park Service, are very passionate about what they do. And I think that having not read the book, but assuming that's the spiritual component is to make your book very distinctive and meaningful and very profound. I want to thank you for writing it.
Lisa, thanks so much. Thank you. This is a good idea for a Father's Day gift.
Yeah, thanks.
Good timing,
isn't
it?
It's very sweet. Thank you.
Mary is in San Marco. Hey, Mary, good morning.
Good morning. And our family has spent many wonderful hours and months traveling to the different national parks, including Crater Lake, Mount Rushmore, the north and south rim of the Grand Canyon. And our youngest son had the privilege of working with Barbara Goodman at the national parks here, which was a wonderful privilege and honor for him, which will stay with him forever. And I just hope that Mark will also think of having a book signing in San Marco.
Oh, there you go. That's a great idea. Let's talk about book signings. Thanks for that call, Mary. You have one tonight at the Bookmark in Neptune Beach.
Right.
7 o'clock tonight, right?
Right, yes.
And are more planned?
Talk to several different places, and so hopefully eventually, yes. But the publisher said, let's focus on this one right away and get this, kind of make this the launch. But yes, there's several different spots that, you know, we mentioned Black Creek Outfitter. First Place Sports. I don't know. There's other bookstores in town, obviously, we could do. So, yes, hopefully we'll be doing more things. But
Are you doing a book tour? Are you going out on the road?
I don't think I'm that high profile on there.
Not yet. Just say not yet.
No. But the publisher has been good about lining up a lot of different interviews, which is different for me being on the other end of questions. I've been pretty busy the last couple weeks and have stuff both locally and on phone interviews with far away places tied to this. And everybody seems to, everybody loves the national parks.
Here's an email from Margaret. Mark Woods is a gift to our city and with this book to the whole country. I can't wait to get my copy. Thanks, Margaret.
Wow, there's a blurb.
Very nice.
That's very nice.
So you can come out and meet Mark tonight at 7 o'clock at the Bookmark in Neptune Beach. He'll be signing copies of Lassoing the Sun. It is out today. And can I ask you one last question? Do you have a favorite national park?
I asked that wherever I went. I asked people, and people ask me that now. And I realized it is kind of very personal. It's not just what had the most incredible vistas, that's part of it, but I think I can't pick one. It's probably like a child, although I have only one, so I can't pick her. But I think it is, I'd have to say, the Redwoods, partly because I went there when I was about 9. I took my daughter there when she was about 9, and that was the last trip my mom did with us. So that and maybe the Grand Canyon, because I keep going back to the Grand Canyon. It's a place that pulls me back. So.
And I'm sure many will be inspired to visit these wild, beautiful spaces after picking up a copy of your book. It's such a pleasure to speak to you, and congratulations. So glad to see all the success around this.
Thank you very much.
Again, Mark Wood's new book, Lassoing the Sun, is out today. You can meet him tonight at the Bookmark in Neptune Beach. And much more still ahead. Coming up next, it's our book club on the show, as our own Stacey Goldring joins us to talk about books some more. And then later, TEDx Jacksonville's incredible music salon this week. We'll be right back.
There's a mindset in corporate America that the job of a company in this economy is to maximize its shareholders' value.
People got greedy, and there's always going to be some people who take it too far and then cause damage.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thing is, the guy who created that theory is having a change of heart. Our series, The Price of Profits, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America is a multi-platform public media initiative that provides a deeper understanding of the impact of poverty on American society. Tune in to the PBS NewsHour weeknights at 7 on WJCT-TV for compelling stories of individuals and organizations addressing such issues. And log on to chasingthedreamproject.org. Funding for this initiative is provided by the JPB Foundation and Ford Foundation. Local funding provided by Wells Fargo.
When Eddie Meltzer's friends were killed at Pulse Nightclub, he decided to put his pain to use, translating for victims' families who only speak Spanish.
Constantly thinking that these parents could have been my parents, and that was tearing me apart.
I'm Ari Shapiro, reporting from a grieving, resilient city. The latest from Orlando on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Jackie Carter, Executive Secretary for Duval County's Emergency Operations Center. Have a plan for home, work, and school. Planning can save you valuable time and money in a disaster. Visit jacksready.com for more information and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
Welcome back. Well, we're talking books some more on the show today. When you read a book, you go on a journey without ever leaving home. And often it's through learning about the characters' dialects, jargon, or even their foreign language. Sometimes that can be thrilling. Sometimes it can be a slog. But there are several classic titles that employ this device. In today's First Coast Connect Book Club, Our own book club leader, Stacey Goldring, joins us to say what? Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good to see you.
Good to see you as well.
And when you mentioned dialect in a book, the first thing I thought of was Tom Sawyer. And that's one of the ones on your list.
Yes, Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn. You know, it's very it just depends when you read a book whether you're going to go with the flow or you're going to have to stop and look everything up or just close the book and say, you know what, I'm not interested. This is too difficult. But there are so many books out there that do have jargon and dialect. And I would ask our listeners to do not throw the book away. Do not close it up, but go with the flow. The author did not intend for you to look up every word or to go ahead and Google everything that is unfamiliar to you. Reading is about the experience. And there are so many wonderful books out there that I encourage you to read that have jargon and dialect as a part of the literary devices that make it up. One, Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston.
Central Florida, Zora Neale Hurston.
Beautiful, beautiful book, and heavy in dialect, and it is just beautiful. Another book that has a lot of foreign language mixed in with it that is not explained, but you get it if you just go with the flow, Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar. I think it's Wow.
I hadn't heard of that one.
Oh, it's beautiful, beautifully done. And, you know, if we want to riff on this a little bit and take it a step further and talk about languages that authors create in order to tell their stories. I don't know if we have any fans of Star Trek, but they did have their own language.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Klingon.
Yeah.
Correct? And
the Lord of the Rings books.
Lord of the Rings. And I believe Game of Thrones was a book before it was a HBO series. And I believe that language is Dothraki. I'm sure someone
we'll probably get a call. By the way, call us up right now with your favorite examples of dialect and language in books or movies. Call us up 549-2937 or email bookclub@wjct.org. And those are three examples of really popular.
Yeah, and they're languages that the author created. Do you remember reading 1984?
Of course.
I remember reading it before the year 1984. Mm-hmm. That's how old I am. And, you know, George Orwell made up an entirely new vocabulary, and he called it newspeak.
Yeah.
And that was, newspeak was, the function of that was to limit thought. So an example of some newspeak vocabulary, you would say something was double plus good, which meant it was the best, or you could say something was double plus bad, which meant it was the worst. And instead of saying that people were talking politically, you could just say they were talking duck speak, which means just quacking. So we've been hearing a lot of duck speak.
Haven't we?
Quack, 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 quack. If we go back to the South again, and we have our wonderful Southern authors, Faulkner employs heavy dialect in As I Lay Dying and Sound and the Fury, beautiful books. A book that you may not have heard of, but I would highly recommend, is called Small Island by Andrea Levy. And it has Jamaican and British dialect. Very heavy, but wonderful. And of course, last month we read a very heavy dialect book, A Brief History, Seven Killings. Now, getting back to coinage. You know I love to make up words.
Yes, okay. You've made up quite a few. Well, like blicks, books that have been made into movies. That's a great new made up word. That should be in the dictionary.
It should. It really should. And biblionexu, which is when something happens in the real world that happened to you and you see it, you're aware of it now. You have the self-awareness because you have it now in your literature. You read it somewhere in a book, and you're like, oh, my gosh, that happened, and blah, blah, blah. Now it's happening in real life, and that happens. But are you familiar with the word muggle?
Oh, from Harry Potter.
Right.
The Harry Potter books had a language all their own.
Oh, my gosh, she has her own huge vocabulary, her own language. Have you ever heard of the phrase, that's some 22, that's a catch 22?
Yeah.
Comes from Joseph Heller. You know, it was supposed to be called catch 18.
Really?
But the year it came out was the same year that Milo 18 came out. So they decided, this was 61, so they decided to change it to catch 22, which even made more sense because the whole idea of catch 22 in the book is about the only way that these pilots can get an excuse for not flying suicide missions in war was if they pleaded catch 22, which was that they couldn't fly because they were insane.
Yeah.
But if you said you were insane, that was a rational thought. So you had to fly the mission. So that was some catch 22.
And so 22 was just a random number.
Yeah. And it ended up working.
Oh,
see, those
gosh.
Are those happy accidents when you're a creative mind. You know all about that, don't you? Okay. So another word is serendipity.
Uh-huh.
Serendipity is a made-up word. It was invented by an author, Horace Walpole, in 1754 because it was based on a fairy tale written in 1557, you heard it here first, called The Three Princes of Serendip. And this was a fairy tale about princes who were always making discoveries by accident about things they weren't really looking for. So so Walpole uses the word serendipity, and Serendip used to be the name of the country Sri Lanka. Who knows these things?
You, Stacy Goldring.
I mean,
she's
this is
brilliant.
Just crazy. This
and,
is crazy.
And let's go to calls for Stacy right now, our brilliant book club leader. It's our book club today on the show. What book or what movie has a language or a dialect that you love? It's 549-2937. Lori is in Jacksonville. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
My very favorite movie dialect and language is when Liv Tyler played Arwen in Lord of the Rings and she was parting the river and she spoke in Elven. That was just beautiful.
Isn't that amazing?
It made me want to learn Elven.
Well, you can because, you know, there's books
people,
out there. And
people
so,
don't,
oh, yeah.
Thank you, Lori. Don't people like meet at Lord of the Rings conventions
and
speak Elvish to each other?
I love that about books. You can go into a whole different world that way that doesn't exist and all of a sudden it exists because you're at a convention doing it. I love that about literature. here is another word that was made up by O. Henry in 1904, and that word is Banana Republic. And now it's a clothing store. But a Banana Republic
right.
is, you know, was like a crazy place from, you know, somewhere in
like a third world nation with a corrupt dictator.
Yeah, bingo.
How did he come up with Banana Republic?
Because he was writing about some place in the tropical south, and so bananas obviously comes to mind as a crop, and your republic being the name for a country. But it's from his from O. Henry's short stories entitled Cabbages and Kings, which that's very fun just on its own. Now, the word beatnik, kind of going off the path, but the word beatnik is kind of fun. That was created by a journalist. Remember those that noble profession, journalism, yeah. In 1958 by San Francisco Chronicle columnist Herb Cohn, and he described a party consisting of 50 beatniks in one of his columns. And this is his quote. I coined the word beatnik simply because Russia's Sputnik satellite was aloft at the time and the word popped out.
If you think about it, all words are made-up words.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Okay, Ed is in St. Augustine. Hi, Ed.
Hi.
Good
morning.
Okay, my book is Anthony Burgess,
Clockwork Orange. I was going to mention
that's
a good
one.
It's such a very scary book. Yeah. I didn't want to bring it up, but you're absolutely right.
I remember one thing. It was a lomtick of toast. It was a piece of toast.
Oh, isn't that beautiful? Oh, my God.
Thanks, Ed.
Thank you, Ed.
Thanks, Ed. Yeah, everyone has their favorites, but this is such a great topic. We could go on and on. But let's mention quickly a couple of things. First off, we are proud to always point out that the Jacksonville Public Library is our partner in the First Coast Connect Book Club with leader Stacy Goldring. If you go to the main downtown library, look for the display and titles that Stacy recommends. You read each month. So some of those this month are Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer by Mark Twain, and The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde by Juno Diaz. Next month, what are we talking about?
Well, we are going to discuss the wonderful authors in the stable of Maxwell Perkins. Now, there's a movie that's coming out, or it's out. Lynn Leary did a great program on it a few days ago on NPR, talking about the film. And
Was a publisher at Scribner's, editor.
Yes, he was an editor at Scribner's, and he fostered the authors F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, Erskine Caldwell, and of course, just a moment of reverence for Thomas Wolfe, Look Homeward, Angel.
And this movie is called genius.
Yeah, and okay, the actors are that Colin Firth, I don't watch a lot of films. Colin Firth and the other guy, Jude Law, and I think that's his name. Anyway, I saw the pictures of that. I saw the film's promo photos, and I think I know what Thomas Wolfe looked like, and I think they miscast. They should have flipped it because Thomas Wolfe definitely looks like the other guy, not the cute one. But anyway, here nor there. I'm sure it'll be lovely. I love to I'll watch anything that does have anything to do with literature. So I'm looking forward to that. And so I suggest we'll be talking about those authors and the influence that this amazing man, Maxwell Perkins, had on literature, American literature, and helping these artists, these authors who were very troubled. He gleaned out their genius, and it takes a genius actually to do that. And one more thing about the library.
And Firth plays him, by the way.
Thank you. He's always in all those British ones, and he always gets the nice girl at the end. Did you know our library has a blog? It has a blog.
Mm-hmm.
And it has the cutest title. It's ilovejpl.org. And you can find all our information on there, Melissa. That's so kind of
them. Fabulous. Okay.
They have these wonderful statistics. So I'm just going to name one before I say goodbye. 77% of Duval County residents have a library card, yet the library only makes up 3% of our city expenditures. Now, I'm not good at math, but that's not so good.
I know. So support the library.
Yes, please.
Get a library card. Support the library. Be vocal about it.
Become a
friend of the library. Here's a tweet from Kingsley Chuck Polanyi's Pygmy is almost entirely written in an invented language. So there's one more tweet.
Oh, what a fabulous author. That's the author of Fight Club.
Email us with your thoughts about the books edited by Maxwell Perkins. We will talk about that next month. Email our book club. The address is bookclub@wjct.org. Stacey Goldring, you are a genius.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to quote you on that, sister.
We'll be right back.
WJCT and Baptist Health invite you to Girls Day Out, Saturday, September 17th at the Hyatt Hotel. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, great speakers, including celebrity chef Mai Pham, and Good Morning America host and breast cancer survivor Amy Robach. Tickets are $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
Coming up on The Next Reveal. 40 years after they were banned, PCBs are turning up in school buildings.
Teachers sign a letter saying, "We think our school's making us sick. Will you test it?"
And parents worry that it's making their kids sick.
How many other parents have their children complaining about headaches or migraines? 75% of the room raised their hand.
On The Next Reveal, from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, this is a great event that will explore music's ability to convey stories about equity, access, and social justice. TEDx Jacksonville is hosting this salon. It's called Music Unites Us. Everything from dance to spoken word performances, musicians, and more is all on the agenda this Thursday. We've got a preview with Sabine Perways, co-organizer and executive producer of TEDx Jacksonville. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, two-time Grammy Award-winning artist, composer, and drummer Ulysses Owens Jr. Good morning.
Good morning.
Such a pleasure to have you here in the studio. You're described as an artist who takes a backseat to no one by the New York Times, a graduate of Juilliard.
Yes.
You'll be at this event, so it's
yes,
great
I
to
will
have you
be.
In town.
Great to be here.
Yeah. What are you going to be doing?
So I'll be on the panel for the event. But one really cool thing is we're actually collaborating with TEDx with my family's organization, Don't Miss a Beat. Mm-hmm. So the event is being hosted at our center and our children will be performing. We're just really, really excited. I've had such great respect for TEDx Jacksonville for many years. So to have something at our home is just we're beyond excited.
That's right. This is at Don't Miss a Beat, which is at 2839 West Beaver Street.
Yes.
Sabine, this is about the power of music.
Yeah, we discovered that Jacksonville has a rich history when it comes to music, one that we don't often hear about predominantly. And when we discovered Don't Miss a Beat, we just felt like it was a natural alignment to focus and feature this topic, but also on what their amazing organization does with our underserved youth and really exposes them to music and the arts in a way that Ulysses does is incredible. And we'll get to hear their performances, but also learn a little bit more about their program.
And Don't Miss a Beat really performs an amazing function because arts education for kids, there's data to show how much that affects their grades, their success later in life.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, I always say, you know, I started Don't Miss a Beat sort of selfishly because I'm a part of that. You know, I didn't necessarily grow up in the inner city. I grew up in the suburbs, but I was very shy and I didn't really know what my purpose was. I started playing drums when I was 2 years old. And from that, you know, by the time I was 16, I went to Douglas Anderson and, you know, was there. And then I moved to New York and now I travel the world for music. So music gave me an identity. And so that is our hope for our children is we're not necessarily trying to create the next Mozart, but if we can help the effect of the arts to give them more direction, then, hey, we're doing our job.
So some of your students will perform Thursday night.
Absolutely, yes.
And there will also be a panel and audience involvement. Yeah.
Yes. So we wanted to feature local musicians, Jose Cruz, Terrence Patterson, and Ulysses Owens. And the moderator will be Jane Condon, who everybody knows as the creator of Douglas Anderson and La Villa. But our goal really was to really bring two diverse communities together, have them interact and learn more about one another. So we're going to have engaging table discussions, kind of icebreakers available for everybody. And we aren't letting people sit where they want. We're kind of structuring the event so you will meet somebody new that you have not interacted with before to expand everybody's horizon. Right.
Fantastic. Now, this is Thursday night, 6 o'clock.
Yes.
Don't Miss a Beat is at 2839 West Beaver Street. Tickets just $10. Yes. Refreshments beforehand.
Yes.
And they get to meet you.
Yeah. And the TEDx Jacks team.
That's right.
And I think there's only one ticket left. So.
Yes. Oh, wow.
Uh-oh.
Well, it's going to be gone. It's now gone. I promise you that. Because you guys did such a good job talking this up.
Well,
so, but support Don't Miss a Beat and support TEDx Jacksonville.
Yes.
It's their salon event, Music Unites Us, Thursday night at 6 at Don't Miss a Beat on West Beaver Street. Sabine Perways, executive producer of TEDx Jacksonville, and Grammy Award winner drummer Ulysses Owens Jr., a proud graduate of Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, come back to town for this. Thank you so much,
both
of you, for sharing this with us.
Thank you.
So much.
Well, that's our show. Thanks again to all of our guests and callers. Diane Rehm is up next. Our show theme is performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik, speaking of music. And our podcast is up every day at iTunes and Stitcher with video on demand at our partner TVJax.com. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.